I continually am amazed at what they're uncovering in Mexico. And I posted this new pyramid. It's the El Cerrito Pyramid. And I say new because I don't read Mexican newspapers. I don't get them. And the Mexican news agencies don't publish a lot of the discoveries that the National Institute of Archaeology, you know, provides, simply because it's a very depressed country. They have a lot of internal strife. They have issues with drugs, and they just have too many problems in reporting on discoveries. Even if they've been around a long time, isn't something that they do on a regular basis. And so when I found this pyramid, it's called El Cerrito. It's south of Mexico City. It's a monster. It's a monstrous pyramid. It's as big as the moon pyramid at Teotihuacan in terms of sheer footprint. And the only issue is that it hasn't been excavated well. It's partially exposed. And the the Spanish, when they came a few hundred years ago, they wiped off the surface of the top and they placed a palace at the top. So it's kind of weird looking, but when you see these photographs, and you can see them on the Facebook page or go to Earth Ancients Facebook, the sheer size of this El Cerrito Pyramid is just, it's fantastic. And it's just sad that we can't get these things. I mean, I've had people write in already and say, hey, it's not that new. It's been around. They've known about it for forever. Well, I don't know about it. I haven't seen it. This is the first time I've actually seen photos of it. But you can see from this gallery of 10 photographs that this El Cerrito is a monster. It's a very, very big pyramid. And to my mind, it's substantial. It's so big that someone needs to get out there and throw some money at it and get it completely excavated. So check that out. And it's sad, again, that there's so many of these undocumented ruins that we just don't know about. I bet you if I went to, when I'm down there again, if I go there and I find a book on known pyramids in Spanish, it probably is in there, but it doesn't cross the border. I've asked around a few people, and they haven't heard of it, and so it's kind of an eye-opener for me. If you're in Mexico listening, I apologize. I don't want to berate Mexico. I love Mexico. I travel there as much as I can. I'm hoping to go there in November. But these kind of undocumented pyramids, at least outside of Mexico, are just fascinating to me and actually are kind of mind-blowing. So check it out. 10 photographs, Earth Ancients. The other thing I want to talk a little bit about is it seems to be that Georgia, the state of Georgia, is becoming a litter ground for ancient Chinese artifacts. And I say that because last week I posted an image of a sword that was found. It's more like a dagger, but it was found in Georgia. And it is dated to be at least about 800 years old. And then I also posted a sword votive, which is the base or the hilt of a sword that is dated to a couple of thousand years old. And it brings to mind the travels of Admiral John Ha, who we heard from Ian Hudson about a month ago, his travels from China. And as these artifacts become more numerous, and by the way, these artifacts that are posted are on the Facebook page, it becomes quite interesting to think that Georgia may have been a settlement of some kind of a Chinese settlement. Now, we've already had a number of people discuss this artifact and say, well, maybe somebody went there in the 1800s and brought it back. The likelihood of that, well, I mean, there's a percentage. You can, you know, look at the odds and say, well, maybe someone went there and their house burned down and this votive was buried in the ground. That's one artifact. Now, we have two now. We have this sword that was found there. So that's two. And these aren't simple, like, raw carved items. They're, you know, there's some decorative design to them that makes them unique. And I'd love to see some more pieces coming out of there. But it's funny because it appears that Georgia is a hotbed for these artifacts. I got an email the other day, and apparently there's more that are coming out, more of these artifacts. So perhaps Zheng Ha and his group or one of his ships came up the Mississippi and then settled and then moved into Georgia. I don't know. Maybe they anchored in Louisiana and came up. Maybe they anchored in one of the Carolinas and came through to Georgia. I don't know. It's fascinating to consider, but these are not recent. This hilt is a couple thousand years old, and you can see them on the Earth Ancients Facebook page. So check them out. It's kind of interesting. So today is a special edition program, Prophecy in the Pyramids with Kurt Nelson. I think you're really going to like this. This was recorded last week, and it's a really unique presentation, and here it is. So my guest today is Kurt Nelson, and Kurt has been studying prophecy for about 40 years, and also he's the author of three books on prophecy, and one on astrology, and another one on the life of Jesus, which is quite interesting. He lectures around the world, and apparently, and I will talk a little bit about this, he's in the middle of a project, a TV project, based on some of his work. So we'll have to ask him about that. Kirk, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This new book, 2026, is filled with prophetic information. And before we get started, because of your background studying prophecy, can you define the kind of prophecy you're referring to? Is it all kinds of prophecy, or is it biblical prophecy, which is something that one of the key figures in the Bible would discuss?
Well, in my study of prophecy throughout the years, I've really found only three sources which are fairly accurate. And that would be Jesus and his prophecies in the Bible, America's greatest psychic, Edgar Cayce, and also astrology is a way that seems to be very accurate in terms of predicting world events.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the three that I have found that actually work. Now, you run into a lot of psychics, erstwhile psychics over the years, and I would say 99% of those seem to be completely wrong in terms of their prophecies and stuff. So so I look at it in terms of a skeptic and say, okay, what are the sources that I trust? And these are the three sources that I've found that I trust.
That's interesting. Can you define for our audience what prophecy is? So that we can get a sense of that as we begin.
Well, prophecy would be using for people. It would be using the universal consciousness to predict the future. Now, the easiest way for the ordinary person to predict the future is through dreams. If you look at the Bible, there's all kinds of stories about precognitive dreams, and of course. Everyone, I think everyone has precognitive dreams. I know I've had them. And Edgar Cayce said that nothing important happens to you that is not first previewed in a dream.
That's fascinating. That really is. Biblical prophecy is unique. And as a scholar of Jesus, as I would think you are, would you say when when Christ is talking about prophecy, he is it's interpreted because obviously the Bible was written after his life. So how is the prophecy of Christ produced? Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. Jesus's prophecies are almost entirely contained in Matthew 24 and the Bible, and they're laid out in very specific terms. And one of the things that he does in that passage is that he quotes the prophecies of Daniel word for word. So he literally refers to Daniel's prophecy as being fulfilled in the future, at some point in the future. So Matthew 24 exclusively is what I would look at for Jesus's prophecies.
Okay.
Now, you also have the prophecies of the Revelation in the Bible, but the Revelation is more of a symbolic book. Edgar Cayce said that the Revelation prophecies were symbolic of the raising of consciousness in the human body, and that all the references to seven this and seven that referred to the endocrine centers of the body and the energy that is raised through meditation and kundalini.
Fantastic. The book, 2026, is a tremendous look at prophecy. Now, you combine a number of biblical figures, Edgar Cayce, and his thousands of readings to pull together the content of this book. But is there something significant that landed you on 2026 that year? Does the prophecy actually land on a specific date, or is it that you have calculated based on these prophecies that is the time period when there's the big change?
Well, about a year ago, I called my literary agent and just to chat. And after a while, she said, I thought you were calling because you wanted to do a book. And I said, I do want to do a book. I want to do a book entitled How to Be Rich, Happy, and Thin. And she laughed at me derisively. So I said, okay, well, what kind of book would you like me to do? And she said, well, something, you know, out there, something on the edge of knowledge and et cetera. And I said, oh, well, I can do that. I can do a prophecy book. And so I got to work on the prophecy book. And, of course, having studied astrology for 30 years, the first thing I did when I decided to do the prophecy book was I looked at the astrology of the next 35 years to see when the best astrological aspects would be. And what I discovered is that the best astrological aspects in the next 35 years are in the year 2026, specifically on the equinox of 2026. So I was very excited about that, decided to put it in the book, and then I got down to the last chapter of and the last page of the last day I was going to work on the book. And I thought, well, you know, I want to look at something on television. And I decided that I would look at a video I had of Graham Hancock and the great writer on the Great Pyramid and Sphinx and all the things in Giza and ancient monuments. So I played his video, and I was watching his video, and he had a photograph that he took. He was allowed to get up on the back of the Sphinx. He got permission from the Egyptian government to get up on the back of the Sphinx and take a photograph on the equinox. And the photograph showed the Sphinx's head lined up perfectly with the rising sun, because the Sphinx lines up with the rising sun, you know, two times a year on the two equinoxes, the spring and fall. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So anyway, I then went on to do some more research and found some more connections with the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid and the equinox, and that's kind of what led me to 2026.
Fascinating. Let's talk about the pyramid. I was referred to by you a page on your website where you show a photograph that was taken at the turn of the century by a pilot of the Great Sphinx of Giza, excuse me, the Great Pyramid of Giza. And the photograph is quite unique, and there's been quite a bit of speculation about it on the internet. And that is because the sun has hit it in such a way that there's eight sides to this pyramid. And I don't know if you can see it from the ground level, but you can see it quite distinctly from the sky looking down from an elevated perspective. What is the significance of this discovery? And you talk a little bit about it, but it really triggers something in what you write about.
Well, Edgar Cayce said that the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx were prophecy in stone. And he said that there were prophecies there that were correct as to the day, hour, place, and individuals involved. And so I got to thinking, how do you build a pyramid to indicate an exact day and time 12,000 years into the future? So it's what has happened here is that the builders of the Great Pyramid indented each side by 1% in the middle, such that it literally has eight sides. The Great Pyramid has eight sides. Now, the other two large pyramids have four sides, but these eight sides can only be seen for 5 minutes twice a year at sunrise and sunset on the equinoxes. And so it was just by chance that this guy was flying over the Great Pyramid at sunset, exactly when the shadow appears, showing that the Great Pyramid has eight sides. So to me, that was indicating, that was the builders of the Great Pyramid indicating that some prophetic event will occur at sunrise or sunset on a future equinox.
Fascinating. Is there something embedded within the pyramid that Cayce reveals in his writing? I've never really thought about it. I've read a lot of Cayce's writings on Atlantis. In fact, there's a whole book that I think one of his sons wrote on Atlantis. But does he talk about the pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Giza?
Well, Cayce said that the Great Pyramid was a temple, not a tomb, and that both Jesus and John the Baptist went through an initiation in the Great Pyramid. And he also said that the interior structure of the Great Pyramid was prophecy in stone, and that the colors of the layers of the stones and the shape and size of the stones indicated the prophecies. And he specifically referred to the sarcophagus and the top, or in other words, the stones over the sarcophagus. And the stones over the sarcophagus, there are five red granite stones and two connecting gray limestones. And they're in the shape of...
Let me stop you real quickly, Kirk. So when you're saying over the sarcophagus, that's the sarcophagus in the king's chamber, correct?
Yes.
The big main room.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. I just wanted to clarify.
And he said that the empty sarcophagus indicated that there is no death or that the soul survives death. When they discovered the king's chamber in the 1800s, they had to blast through a 24-foot granite plug with dynamite to get to the king's chamber. And when they got there, it was empty. There was nothing there because it's never been a tomb. And in fact, there has never been an indigenous burial found in any of the large pyramids. There was a great moment at ARE a few years ago when Zahi Awas, the Director of Antiquities for Egypt, came to speak, and they had questions, and a little old lady came to the microphone, and she said, have there ever been any bodies found in any of the large pyramids? And he said, no. And she said, well, then they're not tombs, are they? And I thought, wow, she just destroyed all of Egyptology with a single question.
That's hilarious.
So
yeah.
Getting back to the prophecy, Cayce said that the prophecy of the king's chamber and the top, referring to those seven stones above the king's chamber, reflected the changes that would occur in religious thought during our time period. Well, what's interesting is you have seven stones in an arrow shape. The two stones at the top are connected. It is a physical symbol of the seven endocrine centers and raising your energy through Kundalini meditation. The five lower stones are red granite, which indicates the five endocrine stones in the body and the neck. The fifth stone is more narrow, just like the neck. The two top stones are connected, and they're made of gray limestone. The pituitary and pineal, the two higher centers, are connected by the hypothalamus. And, of course, they're in the brain, which is made of gray matter. So it was and the way that I discovered this was really funny, because I looked at that diagram for years. And, of course, I should have figured it out the first 5 minutes. And I never could figure it out. I'm like, what does this mean exactly? I never could figure it out. And then one day I was in that in-between state between awake and asleep, and suddenly it hit me. Oh, my God, this is an arrow. It's so obvious. And it represents the seven endocrine centers. So that's the prophecy that's contained in the Great Pyramid. Now, there's another aspect to this, which I've actually just discovered in the last few weeks or so. There's a French architect by the name of Jean-Pierre Houdin, who sold his house, quit his job, moved into a studio apartment in Paris to dedicate his life to figuring out how the Great Pyramid was built. And after about a year, the French government found out about him, gave him $100,000 a year and a staff of five people.
Wow.
So he had, you know, major resources to figure this out. And as an architect, he would look at the Great Pyramid in a way that's different from you or I or any, you know, even an Egyptologist. He looks at the stones and says to himself, why did they do it this way? And he would know as an architect. So one of the things that he figured out was, and this is really, really astonishing, I'm very excited about it, is that there's some stones on the wall of the Great Pyramid which are arranged in a very peculiar fashion. They're arranged as a doorway, if you will, with one large transverse stone on top, taking all of the weight from above away from the stones in the portion of these stones, which would be like a doorway. And then at the very bottom stone at the floor has a transverse stone over it, such that there is no downward pressure whatsoever on that stone. In other words, that stone could be removed, and it would have no effect at all on the stones above it. And when they did soundings in the Great Pyramid to look for empty chambers, they found that there was an opening behind this stone. And when they tested the edges of the stones around it, they couldn't fit a razor blade through all the other stones, but through that stone on the bottom, they could slide a credit card through. Mm. So since the King's Chamber was blocked by a 24-foot granite plug, if it was to be a temple of initiation, there had to be a way for Jesus and John the Baptist to get into the King's Chamber. There had to be a secret entrance. And basically, Jean-Pierre Houdin has figured out where the secret entrance is. That stone could easily be slid away, and there be a passageway behind it leading to the outside.
Fascinating.
Now, there's also a gabled. There are gabled stones in above what they call the common entrance to the Great Pyramid. And these gable stones take all the pressure off the two stones below them, such that those stones could be removed and not affect anything. So that's where the entrance is from the outside, and then the entrance from the King's Chamber is where that stone next to the floor is. Now, just to expand further on Jean-Pierre Houdin, he figured out that the Great Pyramid was built with an internal ramp, that they hauled the stones up a sort of corkscrew-shaped internal ramp. Now, one of the problems with figuring out how the Great Pyramid was built was if they built it with an external ramp, the external ramp would have to be larger than the pyramid itself.
Right.
And there was no evidence of an external ramp at all. So for millennia, no one has been able to figure out how the Great Pyramid was built. Well, Jean-Pierre figured it out. It was built with an internal ramp. So he started to go around lecturing in France about his discovery that this is how it was built, et cetera, et cetera. And after one of his lectures, a scientist came to him and said, you know, I have the proof that this is how the Great Pyramid was built. I was part of a team that did an internal scan of the Great Pyramid, and they found the internal ramp in this scan like 30 years ago, but nobody knew what it was. They never could make the connection until Jean-Pierre laid out his theory. So not only do we have the prophecies in the Great Pyramid that Casey talked about, but we have the information now of exactly how it was used as a temple of initiation.
So is it your belief that that's why this amazing structure was built for human initiation, human transformations of some kind? We've had a number of different scientists and research investigators on this program that believe that the pyramid was some kind of an engine, some kind of a working engine. And if that's the case, maybe there was a process where initiates would go through, changed in some way.
Well, this is another fascinating aspect of it. If you think about Jesus or John the Baptist going through an initiation in the Great Pyramid in the King's Chamber, what form would that take? Well, they would remove the stone. They would enter the Great or the King's Chamber through the passageway where that stone is. They would lay in the empty sarcophagus. The priests would leave. And at that point, they would be in complete darkness, in complete silence, with an entire pyramid of stone focusing this energy onto them. So it would be a life-changing event in any case, because if you went into meditation at that point, there'd be no external stimuli because there'd be no sound, no light. And then, of course, years ago, they used to talk about pyramid energy a lot, how it could sharpen razor blades, how it could prevent fruit from rotting,
right,
and that sort of thing. So if you had a pyramid of that size, and, of course, the King's Chamber is directly in the center of the Great Pyramid, it would focus this energy. And if you were attuning yourself through meditation, it seems like it would accentuate that. It would be, in other words, it was okay, set up to be the perfect sort of meditation chamber to raise Kundalini and raise yourself to a higher level.
But is there something that you have discovered or that you hypothesize that happens physiologically to the body when they enter the pyramid and then do this initiation and then come out? The person's obviously had an extraordinary experience, but is there some physiological process that has changed the body when they come out?
Well, I mean, there are physiological processes with respect to meditation.
Right.
And this involves raising a vibratory level to a higher vibration. Now, in terms of the scientific aspects of this, as you move toward, we know from Einstein that as an object moves toward the speed of light, time slows down. And when you reach the speed of light, time stops. In other words, the speed of light is at a level of the eternal. So to me, this is the scientific proof of eternal life of the soul, that sort of thing. So when you're in meditation, you're raising your vibratory level to a higher speed, approaching that speed of light. Of course, the electrons in your brain are transferred at 99.9% of the speed of light. So your brain acts as a brake to slow the soul down enough to enter physical reality. So it's all part of that reality. Basically, it's a physical reality that we know that time slows down as we speed up. So what you're doing in meditation is speeding yourself up to that vibratory level where time stands still.
Casey talks quite a bit about the Atlanteans in a number of his readings, and he doesn't say it directly, but it's my understanding that the Great Pyramid of Giza was built with very sophisticated technology. Obviously, to be able to cut these 50 and 60 ton blocks and place them into such perfect position without any mortar or sealant of any kind is a work of genius. But the thing that I believe is that he describes the Atlanteans as a spiritually sophisticated society. And if they built this pyramid with the help of the Egyptians at the time, they must have had a sense of its purpose as this, for lack of a better word, a physical accelerator of some kind. And is that what your belief is? Is it that this thing was this amazing pyramid was created to basically transform just a specific number of people? It just seems like there must be more to it than just that. It's so damn big. You know what I mean?
Well,
what do you think
that? Well, there's a couple of things involved here. And Jean-Pierre Houdin has shown that the Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid was used as a used to house a sled, which would carry a counterweight, which would allow them to haul the largest granite stones over the King's Chamber up the other side of the pyramid. And in fact, the grease stains that grease the sled coming down the Grand Gallery are still on the wall of the Great Pyramid. So some of the, my personal feeling is it's not necessary. It was not necessary for them to use exotic Atlantean methods to build the Great Pyramid. He basically, Jean-Pierre has shown that they used an eternal ramp, which they could haul the blocks up. They used the Grand Gallery as a counterweight to bring the super large granite stones. So it was not necessary to use Atlantean technology. Now, Casey also says that the Atlanteans came to Egypt as Atlantis was sinking, and that one of the things that they did with the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx is that they left a repository of ancient knowledge called the Hall of Records between the Sphinx and the river, and that the entrance to this Hall of Records is by the right front forepaw of the Sphinx. So for me, Casey said that they conceived the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx as a temple of initiation, that being the Great Pyramid, and then the Sphinx being the guardian of this ancient knowledge, which will be opened during our time period. Now, Casey said that in the Hall of Records, they had placed the history of man from 10 million years BC through the time of Atlantis to be opened during our time period. And he said that the entrance is by the right front forepaw. Now, I talk about this in the book. They have done soundings, or different types of soundings around the right front forepaw. And they did find a natural fissure in front of the Sphinx. They sent a camera down, and it was just a natural fissure. But along the right front forepaw of the Sphinx, they couldn't find anything. And they did these soundings. They did acoustical soundings where you take a metal plate and you hit it with a sledgehammer, and then the sound waves are reflected back. That's real. It's real rudimentary. But when they did these soundings, on the last afternoon of the last day, Mark Lehner, who was in charge of the Sphinx for the country of Egypt at that point, insisted that they put the acoustical soundings in a small masonry box, which juts out from the side of the Sphinx. And when they did these soundings, it indicated that there were three openings beneath this masonry box. In addition, Stanford Research Institute had done soundings 4 years earlier that indicated there was a vertical shaft beneath this masonry box. So I believe that the entrance to the Hall of Records is beneath this masonry box, or at least somewhere near the masonry box. Now, one of the really exciting things that I discovered was that this photograph taken of the Sphinx of the Giza Plateau at sunset on the equinox, the shadow of the second pyramid is pointing directly to the Sphinx. So, to me, that indicated that the Hall of Records will be opened at sunrise or sunset on some future equinox. So I was very excited about this. And then about a week later, I thought, maybe there's some more information in this photograph than I realize. So I took a business card and I lined up the shadow with the business card, and I realized that the shadow was pointing directly to that right front forepaw masonry box.
Oh, my God. You're talking about the photograph of Graham Hancock, right?
No, the photograph that the British military pilot took,
showing the
shadow on the Great Pyramid.
Oh,
so
wow.
It shows
okay.
this shadow that only appears twice a year for 5 minutes at sunrise or sunset on the equinox. The shadow appears telling us the time, and the shadow of the second pyramid shows us the place. Because Casey said that prophecies built into the Great Pyramid were correct as to the day, place, time, and individuals involved. So by showing the shadow and having the other shadow point to the right front forepaw box, they're telling us the time and the place that the Hall of Records will be opened. Now, there's something else that is even more amazing is that they have actually done a physical survey of the Giza Plateau with surveying instruments and all this sort of stuff. And the actual survey, the on-the-ground survey with the exact down-to-the-centimeter lines drawn, the shadow from that second pyramid goes directly through the right front forepaw box, and then it goes directly through the middle of the Sphinx Temple. And the Sphinx Temple was built at the time that the Sphinx was built because the blocks were taken out of the enclosure and put in front of the Sphinx. So they have lined up the second pyramid directly with this right front forepaw box and directly with the central median of the Sphinx Temple. And Casey has told us that the Hall of Records is between the Sphinx and the river. And I will bet you dollars to donuts that the Hall of Records is somewhere on that line going toward the river. Now, when they did testing, groundwater testing between the Sphinx and the river, and they drilled down, and about 50 feet down, they found red granite. And red granite is not indigenous to the Giza Plateau. So there's something down there 50 feet made out of red granite between the Sphinx and the river.
Fascinating. Based on your research and the writings of a number of different scholars, how old would you say that Giza Plateau is? Of course, you know about the Robert Schock, John Anthony West study and both of them saying it's significantly older. But what do you feel about the age, a possible age for that area?
Well, the water weathering of the Sphinx enclosure indicates that it's at least 10,000 years old. Casey said that the whole structure was built in 10,500 BC. So we know that the Sphinx is at least 10,000 years old. We know that the Sphinx temple is that old because they were both built. We know they were built at the same time. They couldn't carbon date the Sphinx because it's a solid block of stone. They carbon dated the Great Pyramid to be about 2800 BC. But there, since the Great Pyramid has this energy that prevents fruit from decaying, is there the possibility that it could prevent a carbon decay in the same way? Mm-hmm. So there's some question about that in my mind. Now, another aspect of this is there seems to be some indication in the readings that the Sphinx was older than the Great Pyramid. He talked about the restoration of the Sphinx and this sort of thing. So, you know, if you're gonna accept Casey, he says that the whole thing was built 10,500 years ago, and it, with the lineup of, but I don't think it's necessarily so, but you know, you have to look at the facts on the ground, and the facts on the ground seem to indicate that the Great Pyramid is younger. So there's some, you know, some question in my mind. Personally, I tend to go with Casey. I think it's all probably that ancient, simply because they have lined up the Second Pyramid with the Sphinx itself. But yet the readings do indicate that talk about the restoration of the Sphinx. So maybe the Sphinx was there before, and then they just came in, built those pyramids, and put the Hall of Records beneath the Sphinx, as you know, in a much more recent time.
You must be following the drama of Zahi Hawass and being removed as the supreme director of the Giza Plateau. I've seen a number of photographs of him in the Sphinx, in various chambers underneath the Sphinx that have come out. And here's a guy who claims that Khufu built the pyramids, or the Great Pyramid, and that the Sphinx isn't very old. But, I mean, this guy must know. I mean, he must be discovering things. And to my mind, I wouldn't be surprised if he already has discovered the Hall of Records and just is keeping a rap on it. But what is your feeling of this guy? I mean, he is I'm not a fan. I just cannot be a fan of his.
Well, the Egyptian government announced last year that they were going to scan all of the pyramids with muon scans and thermal scans on the outside. It's called the Scan Pyramids Project.
Right.
And last November, the director of antiquities had a press conference in front of the Great Pyramid showing that they had found with the thermal scans that there were two or three blocks there that were super hot, indicating that there was a passage behind them. Then, and when they did this, Zahi Hawass wrote a blistering editorial in one of the magazines about how the Egyptologists should be in control of this, and that all of these people using these scans were just advertising their equipment for publicity, and he just was really, really against it. So then they announced that they were going to scan the Great Pyramid in February with the muon scans, but about 2 weeks ago it was announced that they actually did a press conference at the Great Pyramid where that they were doing the muon scans that day, and that Zahi Hawass had been placed in charge of the scanning program.
Oh boy.
And so the first thing that they were going to do was they were going to scan the pyramid to see if the existing chambers show up on the scan. In other words, they were testing the veracity of the muon scan. Now, they had already done a muon scan of the Red Pyramid, which had found indicated chambers there. They felt they had found chambers there. So here we have, it seems ironic that the guy who is completely against the scanning is now in charge, but now his tone has changed, and he has indicated that, you know, that perhaps we can discover something here and that sort of thing. So it's possible that that his attitude has changed. Now, my feeling about Zahi Hawass is that, you know, we're all here for a reason, right? And it's possible that, it's more than possible. Obviously, the man has enormous karma from past lives tied up in the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. And when I've met him, you know, briefly, not really, didn't really have a conversation with him or anything, but he has enormous charisma. And I felt very drawn to him, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that he sort of poo-poos everything I believe in. But, you know, people make mistakes, people are wrong. But yeah. I feel that he is definitely somehow part of the process. Now, I don't believe there's a lot of stuff on the internet about, oh, he's found the Hall of Records, et cetera. I don't believe that because, first of all, I don't think that they could keep it a secret. And secondly, Casey said that there were guards left protecting the Hall of Records such that it would not be discovered until the selfish motives of the world are broken up. And there's a legend that I read years ago, and I haven't been able to find it again, but I read it like 30 years ago, that there was a pharaoh who discovered secret chambers under the Sphinx, and he sent two men in to examine them, and they came out covered with sores. So he covered the entrance, and he placed a god of the underworld on top of the entrance. Well, when the Sphinx was uncovered in 1857 from the sand, they found a broken statue of the god Osiris, who is the god of underground tunnels in the New Kingdom, right next to the right front forepaw masonry box. So it won't be discovered until there is a break in history. And the break in history is, in the Bible, described as the 1,000 years of peace. The astrologers talk about the age of Aquarius. The fundamentalists would talk about the second coming of Jesus. All of these things, I think, are describing the same event, which I believe will occur in that 2026 time period. Because what's happening in that time period is that there is an alignment of Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus, which only occurs about every 35 to 50 years or so. And it's so rare and it's so long lasting because it lasts from 2024 through 2027. It lasts for about 3 years or so. And whenever we have these time periods, it's a time when the human race makes a sort of jump, a break in history. Now, one of the last times that we had this was November of 1989. And November of 1989 was when the greatest event of the last quarter of the 20th century occurred, the fall of the Berlin Wall. So here we have especially Neptune and Saturn together, conjunct in the sky. This represents physical manifestation of spiritual ideals. And in this case, political freedom. Now, also in November of 1989, UFOs appeared over Belgium. They were seen by thousands of people. They were tracked on radar. They were there for months. They came back for months, were seen in the daytime and all this sort of stuff. Of course, not a peep about it in the American press. I didn't hear about it until years later. But I think this is part of it as well, the you know, first contact with aliens and that sort of thing. So we have to look forward to this time period of an extreme evolution of the human race and the physical realization of man's spiritual nature.
Okay.
That's what I think is going to happen during that time period.
Let's talk a little bit about that. 2026, we're talking the year 2016. 2026, that's 10 years from now. And in your book, you're describing a change in what I'm guessing body, mind, and spirit of this future Earth human. Can you talk a little bit about the prophecies that you've discovered, perhaps what maybe Christ predicted or other people predicted, maybe even Casey predicted about this new human in 2026?
Well, there are a couple of things here. And Martin Luther King said that the arc of history is long and it bends toward justice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at there are a number of things that are going on right now that I feel are bending toward this break in history. One of which is that we are on the verge of finding life on other planets. They have found water on Mars, liquid water on Mars. They have found a liquid ocean on the moon Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, a salty liquid ocean that's actually larger than the ocean on the Earth. They are launching a satellite, the James Webb telescope, that is 100 times more powerful than the Hubble telescope. They are launching planet-hunting satellites that will be able to discover hundreds of Earth-like planets. We will also have this jump in our ability to examine the elements of the atmospheres of all these planets. So we're on the verge of literally finding life on other planets and perhaps being able to discover alien civilizations as well. And it seems that this arc of history is leading to all of this culminating in the 2020s. So if there was no prophecy... Oh, also, the other thing is we have just discovered how to manipulate the DNA and RNA of every living creature on Earth easily and cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be able to create a new type of human being with this genetic manipulation. So the
okay.
arc of history seems to be leading us toward discovering alien civilizations, changing our DNA, changing the human body for the better, such that the prophecies that you just described would seem to be something that would happen even if there was no religious or supernatural aspect to it. Of course,
mm-hmm.
the supernatural is just a different description of reality. Science and religion have the same job. Their job is to describe reality. And ultimately, those two things will unite. But anyway, getting back to the prophecies you asked me about, Jesus says that there will be an invasion of the Middle East, that the invader will be destroyed by fire. After he is destroyed by fire, there will be a darkening of the sun and the moon. Now, this omen of a darkening of the sun and the moon is mentioned 6 times in the Bible. It's also in the Quran. It's also in the Jewish Bible. So it is an omen that is recognized by 3 of the world's religions as being an example or the first part of this sort of break in history that we're talking about. In addition, the Bible says there will be 1,000 years of peace. Casey says that echoes that in terms of a time when the selfish motives of the world will be broken up. The Bible says Jesus will return. Casey says Jesus will return. It seems like that is somehow connected with alien first contact because there's some question. It seems clear that the aliens are not human beings riding around in spaceships. They are a superior type of being, probably a superior being spiritually, whether they're angels or, you know, if they reach that level or not, who knows, but clearly there is a connection between all of these different things. So what I envision is the opening of the Hall of Records, the return of Jesus, first alien contact, and then the creation of this new physical human being. All of those things sort of happening at once.
Interesting.
Just a huge break in history.
So in your thought process, you believe that science will, in the next 10 years, will take a quantum leap, and we will all have the ability probably to live longer, which I've read a little bit about, but also we'll have complete changes in our physical makeup that will change us as a race. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and that's what Casey said. Casey talks about the fifth root race, that there will be literally a new physical type of human body. He never really described it, and nobody really asked him what it was. But even, like I said, even if there were not these prophecies, it's clear that we're going to have the ability to change our bodies with DNA. But what's interesting is that Casey used the word introgression in describing this. And the word introgression means gene splicing. And I'm not even sure DNA had even, I mean, Casey died before DNA was even discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to use the word introgression was remarkable, I think.
Pretty revolutionary, actually. Can you talk a little bit about the, because we've had Native elders on the show talking about different root races and the different Earth periods where humans were under specific kinds of conditions. Can you describe what the fifth root race is?
Well, Casey said that there was a rebellion in the celestial, and that souls started to project themselves into matter, and that they could move in and out of matter at will, that they could project into rocks, into trees, into animals, into anything that they wanted to. But gradually, over time, they became trapped in animal bodies. And this would be the sort of primitive man that were the different forms of primitive man. Like anthropologists have discovered Gigantopithecus,
right,
over 8 feet tall, Australopithecus, a dwarf-like hominid. There were many different forms of animal forms during early times, and Casey said that then the son, what he called the sons of God, which are talked about in the book of Genesis, that the sons of God came in to the earth plane to try to help, and then some of them became trapped, and then they decided that what they needed was one single form that had higher centers. That could, in other words, these primitive forms, it would take millions of years for them to evolve to where they could develop their higher centers and escape material reality. So he said that the sons of God created Homo sapien with the higher centers, the pituitary and the pineal, in order to allow a form that the souls could enter into to escape materiality by developing themselves spiritually. And there's a thing in anthropology, they talk about the great leap forward, that there was a period when suddenly human culture took a big leap forward with the cave paintings and sophisticated tools and that sort of thing. And according to Casey, this was the time period when the Atlanteans created Homo sapien, when Homo sapien was created, and that Adam was actually a previous incarnation of Jesus, and that when he fell in the garden, it became his karma to overcome death, since he was the first to experience death with the fall in the garden. So there's a lot of things going on here in terms of prehistory. Now, talking about science, the relationship between science and religion, this is something that's come to really fascinate me recently, is that, you know, the scientists say that they don't know what 95% of the universe is made of. And so they have given this 95% that they can't identify a name. They call it dark matter and dark energy. Mm-hmm. And they call it dark simply because it means they don't know what it is. So they know that dark energy is creating the universe outward at the speed of light, but they don't know what dark energy is. But to me, it sounds like dark energy is God, because it is this dark energy, what they call dark energy, is creating the universe at the speed of light. We know that as you approach the speed of light, time slows down. When you reach the speed of light, time stands still. So this something, whatever it is, exists at a level where there is no time. And and whatever this force is, it's the thing that's creating the universe. So either that is the God force, or it is certainly some representation or some part of the God force. Personally, I think it is the God force itself. I think they have discovered the God force. They just don't want to give it that name.
That's fascinating. In your research, can you give us an example of the type of human that we're moving into? Is there any current examples that you have discovered where you can say, well, this is a new development, a new discovery on how humans work, how the human physiology work, how we reason, how we think? Is there something that you can tag that would say, okay, this is the beginning of this new development, this new evolution of humankind?
Well, I would just, the only thing I could point to, I couldn't point to anything current, but I would say the sons of God that are talked about in the book of Genesis. Casey said that the sons of God were higher spiritual beings, that he said both sexes were contained in one body. They were androgynous beings. And if you study Casey, it's the only way that the book of Genesis makes sense. Because Casey talks, if you look at the book of Genesis, there were two creations. The book of Genesis said God created man in his own image. Okay. And then it says God created Adam. So those are two different creations. Now, when God created man in his own image, that is the soul creation, the part of us that is a God. Jesus said, you are gods. And Casey said that even God doesn't know what you're going to do, what decision you're going to make at any point. God has given us free will. By definition, then, we are all gods because we have free will. God has given us this little part of himself, that soul, that has free will, that can do whatever it wants to. So the sons of God are the answer to your question. The closest thing I can think of are the sons of God. Now, are the sons of God the same beings that are flying saucers in our atmosphere and visiting us on occasion with the UFOs and stuff? Possibly. I think that's I would lean toward that idea, that you have these higher spiritual beings. You know, the physical universe has been around 13 billion years. Mm-hmm. Human culture has only been around a few thousand years. So there are civilizations out there that have had billions of years to develop themselves spiritually. And I think that the sons of God are the best example of a different type of being that you're describing.
Okay. In the time we have left, and we're almost at the end of our program here, let's talk about UFOs. I've studied the subject a lot. I used to be the conference director for an expo that had panel discussions and had some of the foremost authorities on it. This is about 20 years ago, but I've kept an eye on it. I do not know of any solid description of humanoids that have been discussed, except for Billy Meyer in Switzerland, who discussed a race of Caucasians who are somewhat like us, but extremely advanced intellectually. I mean, most of the current connections with aliens are these grays that have no level of Caucasian or Earth human in them. They're totally unique in their own form. What I mean, if these aliens are here to give us more information, or perhaps are from worlds where hundreds of thousands of years ago we had a connection of some kind. What do you think the whole path is? Why don't we know more about this? Why do we only see their ships? I mean, because they've been around since the 40s, and probably even before that, before we even had radar. Do you have any idea, any concept on that at all?
Well, there's a couple of things going on here. Every 2,165 years, the Earth goes from one astrological age to the next. The past astrological age was the age of Aries, which Aries is a fire sign symbolized by the bull. So the religious practices then involved sacrificing a bull on an altar of fire. Then we moved into the age of Pisces, which is a water sign symbolized by the fish. So the rituals became baptism, and we talk about Jesus as being the fisher of men. The next astrological age will be Aquarius, which is an air sign symbolized by the man pouring the pitcher of water. So from my perspective, this break in history will be the age of Aquarius, and the aliens are simply waiting for us to evolve to a more peaceful, loving world before they are ready for first contact. Now, I see a pattern in what they have been doing over the last 100 years or so. It seemed like in the beginning, they simply showed themselves, like they appeared over Washington, D.C. in 1952, Roswell, Los Angeles, all that sort of stuff. In the beginning, they were originally just showing themselves. Okay, here we are, get used to us, just to kind of get the human race used to the idea. Then in the 1960s and 70s, there were a lot of visitations to nuclear bases in the U.S. and around the world, examining this whole arms race and perhaps sending us a message that, this is not acceptable, et cetera. They may have done it in a more overt manner. We may have made a deal with them. Because if you look at, it's interesting because the only person who ever asked U.S. presidents about UFOs is Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel has asked several of the U.S. presidents directly, do they know about UFOs? And their response has been kind of yes, but I can't tell you.
Right.
So I'm not sure that we haven't made a deal with them on some level. That's a possibility. But getting back to my main point, the pattern that you see. So first they appeared, then they were involved with the nuclear bases a lot, and then there were a lot of mass sightings. We had Belgium where thousands of people saw them. We had Phoenix where thousands of people saw them. So that they're sort of the mass sightings, but once again just showing themselves. And then in recent years, they've kind of pulled back, I think, because of the a billion smartphones on the planet. If you had mass sightings now, there'd be hundreds of videos of it. It would be more of a complete revelation than
right.
just a little sort of us getting used to them. Now, one of the aspects for 2026, this Saturn-Neptune conjunction, the physical representation of the physical manifestation of the influence of Neptune, which would be outer space, UFOs, that sort of thing. I think that's all going to be part of it. So I think that they are waiting for us to evolve to a higher level before it would be even be safe for them to interact with us, because you know, our violent nature now and the sort of tribal nature that we're involved with. So they're waiting for us to evolve. Casey also described this as a testing period. In other words, it sounds like we as souls are being tested as far as that goes. So I think it's just a question. It's almost like Star Trek and the Prime Directive, you know, no interference. They
exactly.
have to step back. They have to step back because we're all souls with free will, right? So
right.
they have to. We have to evolve to this higher level. And there is this break between the age of Pisces and the age of Aquarius.
Yeah, that Prime Directive has come up on a number of shows when we discuss alien interventions, and I actually we've had Mayan elders that we've talked to and I've talked to who believe and have had their history has discussions of contact with aliens from different planets. And you know, one of the biggest problems I have with ancient aliens is they believe that our civilization has been spawned by aliens, and the Maya don't believe that at all. They believe that there was interaction, but there was never a huge playbook on here's how you do it kind of thing. So
right.
anyhow, that's my own feeling about Ancient Alien, the series.
Yeah, well, my feeling is that Casey said that the Atlanteans had the ability to transpose matter from one end of the universe to the next.
Hmm.
And so when you start talking about angels, aliens, it's almost like, okay, are they the same thing? Are they, you know, they're higher spiritual beings? It's an interesting thing. And I just go back to, once again, the sons of God, because of the descriptions in Genesis and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. There was this interaction with these higher beings. But you know, from Casey's perspective, it was the souls became trapped in Earth. A new type of body had to be created. A Homo mm-hmm. sapien was created, and then human culture has played out on Earth for the last 200,000 years or so.
It's fascinating. Tell us a little bit about this TV series. You're working with a group, a network or somebody to develop a series?
No, we haven't found anybody yet, but what we really would like to do is either a documentary about the mm-hmm. Shadow on the Pyramid discovery, because that's really, I think, a unique and exciting discovery. For the last 75 years since that photograph was taken, nobody has known why the builders of the Great Pyramid built it with eight sides until I figured it out. And so it's a unique discovery, and it's something that I really would like to publicize with a documentary along the lines of the Mysteries of the Sphinx documentary that they did in mm-hmm. the 1990s.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, you never know who's listening. We do have producers that do listen to the show. My guest today has been Kirk Nelson. The book is 2026, and it's available on Amazon. But also I want to let people know that Kirk has a website. It's called, 2026awakenings.com, AWAKENINGS, 2026awakenings.com. So fantastic, Kirk. Thank you very much. This has been fascinating. We've had quite a few, like I said, people talking about what they believe the functionality of the pyramid was from an intellectual side, but no one has talked to us about the prophecies of Casey, of the various biblical figures and other people. So it's been fun. We really appreciate having you on the program.
I appreciate you having me.
All right. Thanks. We look forward to hearing more from you.